weather conditions, you know, people were trickling in. So, again, you know, we're grateful for everyone here holding out and not raising hell. I promise you it's going to be a great program. And first off, my name is Manco Rojas. I'm with the Ad Hoc Nepal Solidarity Committee. And we're very glad that everyone was able to come, regardless of the weather. It's going to be a very special event. And I'm sure everyone picked up a program at the desk up front. But disregard the times. But obviously the introduction is now. But we're gonna have our featured speaker here, Leo Nesto, to take us on a tour of Nepal. She's going to go through some excerpts of the dispatches, the report from the People's War in Nepal, which we've been promoting a lot in our building for this event. She's going to get into the slideshow, and I'm sure everyone's going to enjoy that. This is going to be a very special treat. I've been looking forward to that for a long time. We're going to be treated to a performance by Mahina Movement. There'll be a brief intermission, about 10-minute intermission. After that, there'll be a presentation on the current situation. Then there'll be a call by the Ad Hoc Nepal Solidarity Committee. And after that, there'll be a question and answer session. And this will be an opportunity for everyone here to ask your questions and share your views about what's happening in Nepal. We ask that there's absolutely no picture taking, and we also ask that there is no leafleting going on in the auditorium. Translations, there is going to be translations, and I'm going to go into my Spanish mode now. Para las personas aquí que están que necesitan una traducción en español, por favor, hace su mano para ver si se necesita. ¿Alguna persona necesita traducción a español? Okay. How about a Nepali? Does anyone need a Nepali translation? Okay. So, without further ado, I want to introduce Lee. In the spring of 1999, Leo Nesto has spent several months as a photo journalist traveling deep into the guerrilla zones in Nepal. The aim of this journey was to capture the passion, voices, and faces of the peasants who have been waging what they call a people's war since 1996. Since her return, Lee has continued to study and write about the developing situation in Nepal, where the Maoists now have control of much of the countryside. So let's give a warm welcome to Leo Nesto.
We step out into the darkness and take off on the path single file. I need to use a flashlight, but somehow the others are able to climb the steep, rocky trail without any illumination. Effortlessly, they zip up the terrain. But this is all unfamiliar and new for me, and I find myself having to concentrate, shining my light so I can see with each step where I'm putting my feet. In the complete darkness, my flashlight beam cuts a hole of light just big enough for me to travel through. And as fast as I can, I move through this small tent of light. Even though I can't see anything around me, my rapid breathing tells me we're going higher and higher up the mountain. After a while, we reach a plateau where people have started gathering for a cultural program. With only two lanterns dimly lighting the area, it's hard to see what's going on, but I can make out the dark outlines of what looks to be about 100 people sitting on the ground. Other villagers are still coming up the hill. I'm squinting into the darkness, trying to get a better look at what's around me. Then suddenly, an image appears right in front of me, someone close enough to reach out and touch. It is my first glimpse at a member of the People's Army. In silhouette, the figure of a young woman in uniform and cap carrying a rifle on her shoulder. The program is still going strong when we leave. We get back to the house, go inside, and lie down. 2 hours later, a bit before 1 a.m., I awaken to someone's voice saying, "Comrades, get up. They are here." I sit up immediately and see that members of the People's Army are coming into the room. It is completely dark except for two small candles, one set up on a table in front of me so I can write in my notebook. The squad members file in and put their rifles up against the wall. The room is very small, and with about a dozen guerrillas plus a couple of local people and the two party leaders from the area, it's very crowded. Some of the young women guerrillas come and sit right next to me on the bed. Now I can see how young they are. They are beautiful and strong and look to be in their late teens, early 20s. They are proudly wearing their People's Army uniforms, military green pants with many big roomy pockets and matching jackets. The caps are sort of squared off on the top with a full brim. A big, bright red star declares from the front. Across from me sits the leader of the squad, a handsome young man who I guess to be about 25 years old. He looks very tired but welcomes me with a big smile. For the next couple of hours, members of this cultural squad tell me about themselves and their revolutionary passion. Almost all of them come from poor peasant families. The women are the first to speak up and talk about the tremendous repression in their villages and how they came to join the People's Army. At first, the women guerrillas seem shy and hesitant, but as each one takes her turn to speak, I am impressed by the strength and determination in their calm manner. They have a character about them that is common to teenage girls around the world. The way they sit next to each other, whisper some secret, or fix one another's hair. But there is also a communal and disciplined way about them that comes from living and fighting together as a military unit. Journal entry, Sunday. Yesterday, a front page article in the Kathmandu Post carried the headline, "Seven Maoists Killed in Encounter." According to the brief article, the incident happened in Banepa. I get my map out and look to see where Banepa is. In fact, it is right along the road that we had traveled on from Kathmandu to the eastern region. In the evening, a friend comes by who had been with us on our trip to the east. He had been back there since and talked with people about the Banepa incident. He tells us that the people killed in the incident were from the cultural squad we met. I am stunned by the news. And immediately, I close my eyes and try to remember their faces. Late in the middle of the night, we had crowded onto the bed together, our legs crossed, knees touching. In the candlelit room, their shadows had loomed large on the walls. I concentrate on remembering the faces of the young women guerrillas, the young women who had left their villages after seeing their families and friends arrested, beaten, raped by the police, their fathers, uncles, mothers forced to go underground before them. Only a short time ago, they had shared their war stories with me. Now seven of them, four men and three women, were dead after refusing to surrender to the police. Someone brings me photos of the guerrillas killed in Banepa. One of them was the young woman, the one with the sweet face, who had been sitting right next to me on the bed that night. Her eyes had shone bright, even in the dim flicker of candlelight. I had heard my first notes of a revolutionary song in Nepal from these youth. They had been the first to teach me their fist in the air, la salam, their red salute. They had given me my first face-to-face conversation with members of the People's Army. They had lived such short lives, but I am told that like other martyrs in this revolution, they will be remembered by all the people who continue to wage this guerrilla war. I will certainly never forget them. That was an excerpt from the 22-part series I wrote, Dispatches, Report from the People's War in Nepal. So I guess now we're going to do the slideshow so we can... In 1996, the Communist Party of Nepal Maoists initiated armed struggle. As a revolutionary journalist for the Revolutionary Worker newspaper, I followed these events with great interest and excitement. But it was really hard to get information about this small, growing guerrilla movement, guerrilla war. And much of the information that we were able to get was unreliable. At the same time, the people in Nepal, who were facing tremendous repression from the government there, wanted to get their story out. They wanted the world to know not only about the goals and aims of their revolution, but how the government was going into the villages and killing people and trying to crush their revolution. So in the spring of 1999, they invited a reporter from the Revolutionary Worker to come carry their story, to cover their story, to travel into the guerrilla zones, and to witness up close firsthand this tremendous struggle. And I had the opportunity to go to Nepal for 3 months, to travel into the east and middle regions, into the guerrilla zones, and to spend 1 month in the western part of the country, in Rolpa Rukam, the heart of the revolution. I was the first foreign journalist to be given this kind of access, to interview party leaders, military commanders, village leaders, guerrillas, families of martyrs, and the common peasants who were putting their lives on the line to free their country and to get rid of the corrupt political regime that was oppressing the people. Nepal is strategically located between India and China. Land-wise, it is about half the size of a country like Italy. In terms of population, there are 23 million people. This is more than the number of people in Australia and about the same number as the people in Iraq. The country was unified in the late 1700s and was never colonized, but foreign powers, especially Britain, exerted economic and political control. And throughout the history, there's been strong instances of armed struggle against corrupt governments and foreign domination. For decades, the political parties in Nepal were banned under a monarchy that existed until 1990. Then in 1990-91, a popular upsurge forced the king to institute a constitutional monarchy with an elected parliament. And the first elections to be ever held in Nepal were in 1991, and popular expectations arose. This is a picture here of the palace, the king's palace in Kathmandu. When I arrived in Kathmandu in February of 1999, the city was very, very tense because of the upcoming elections. The Maoists had called for a countrywide ban, and the government was determined to carry out these elections to prove their hold on power and the stability of their government. But everywhere I went, I could see signs of the Maoist influence in the city. And this here, this is right outside of one of the main college campuses, graffiti done by the Maoist student organization that people who have followed the news in the last couple of years know that the Maoist students have organized countrywide bonds, strikes, basically shutting down schools throughout the country. And at this time, they were really strong in the cities. And so there was evidence everywhere in the city of support for the Maoist bonds and the struggle in the countryside. Nepal is a semi-feudal, semi-colonial country, and its development has been controlled and distorted by imperialism over the decades. Its transportation, its communication, its system, communication systems are very primitive, and its industry is severely underdeveloped. It is one of the poorest countries in the world, and foreign powers, especially India, have exploited the resources and labor power of this country for many, many decades. Most of the areas in Nepal are so rugged and remote that it takes days of walking up and down the steep terrain. Sometimes there aren't even paths to get into where people live. And the villages themselves are very, very poor in these remote areas. More than 85% of Nepal's population of 23 million people are poor peasants who live on tiny plots of land with no electricity. There's no running water or basic sanitation. Malnutrition is really widespread, and life expectancy is only about 55 years. Healthcare is basically non-existent. And I know when I was there, there was a flu epidemic that was going on. And this was just like a common flu, the kind that if people hear, if you got the flu, maybe you'd have to take a day or two off of work or school. But this kind of flu in Nepal meant that, you know, scores and dozens of older people and young children were dying. 50% of the people earn less than a dollar a day, and the average income is only about $230 a year. Many of the people can't feed their family on the tiny plots of land, and so they have to seek work for many months out of the year, either in the cities of Nepal or many, many in the cities of India across the border. And there's even a lot of Nepalese increasingly being exported to work, like in the oil fields in the Middle East. I heard that Israel was trying to import labor from Nepal. So this is a phenomenon that's going on, and a lot of the peasants are having to leave the countryside and even leave Nepal to look for work. Now, land is a really essential issue to the struggle in Nepal. And when it comes to land, there is great inequality. The poor peasants in Nepal make up about 65% of the population, but they own only about 10% of the land. Meanwhile, the rich peasants and landlords in Nepal make up only 10% of the population, but own more than 65% of the land. In the Terai area, the kind of more flat land area of Nepal along the border with India, there are many landless peasants and big landlords. In the other parts of Nepal and the mountain regions, which make up most of the countryside, the peasants mainly own their own land. But they are very small, tiny plots, not enough for them to feed their family. And they also face, you know, tremendous repression and getting ripped off by small moneylenders, corrupt officials, and small landlords. When I was in Nepal, I interviewed a lot of peasants in these villages who told me stories about how they had been ripped off by what they called liars and cheaters. These were landlords and moneylenders and corrupt politicians. For instance, one 50-year-old peasant told me a story about how his family worked for 18 hours every day and still couldn't grow enough food to feed their family. So he borrowed money from a moneylender at 36% interest for 1 year. In order to pay back this debt, he went to the city to work as a laborer, but brought back only enough to pay the interest on the debt. The conditions of loan for the landlord was that he had to, until he paid back the loan, he had to work 2 days a month for the landlord and also give milk from the goats. And this was kind of like a very common situation, and many times this would lead to the poor peasant farmer even losing their land, because when they couldn't pay back the debt, the landlord would demand that they pay back with their land. And so this is one way that a lot of poor peasants would actually lose their land and become landless. This peasant told me, while he was working 18 hours a day and unable to feed his family, meanwhile the landlords are happy getting money and doing no work. My first trip into the guerrilla zones was in the east, into a village where there was developing Maoist support for the Maoist revolution. And these school children gave me a tour of this is their school. You can see it's pretty primitive. And the educational system there is a lot of the girls aren't allowed to go to school. And a lot of the children are, even though there's schools in the villages, they aren't able to go to school because they're, you know, have to work on the land and work to help farm the land to feed their family. In this village, there was signs of support for the Maoist graffiti in the villages. And this one here on the wall, it said, eliminate repressive laws, release political prisoners, Eliminate Liars and Conspirators, and it's signed by the CPN Malice. And the kids also took me around to show me this is the Common Village water tap, and it had this graffiti on it that said, let's go ahead on the path shown by Martyr Gobangali. And this was, they kind of written this to remember one of the people from their village who had been a martyr, someone killed by the police in the People's War. The Communist Party of Nepal, Maoist, initiated armed struggle on February 13, 1996. And this radically changed the whole political situation in Nepal. When I was in Nepal, I was able to do an extensive interview with Prachanda, the chairman of the Communist Party of Nepal, Maoist, who has been underground now for many years. And I asked him what it was like for the party to take that huge leap to begin armed struggle. And he told me, he said, we had a Politburo meeting, and we synthesized the experience of this 1 month. It was a big transformation process for the whole party, for the whole of our mass organization, because it was not a gradual change. It was a big question of life and death struggle, and everything was shaken. We concluded that the party's first plan of initiation had proven to be correct and really shaken the country. Then the enemy started to massacre the people, arresting, raping, killing, and looting. He talked about how it took tremendous sacrifice and commitment, and that the whole character of the party and its work changed. That many of the people who had been doing above-ground open political work in the cities now had to go underground, to quit their jobs, go into the countryside, and become full-time revolutionaries. Before they initiated armed struggle, the composition of their party had mainly been made up of students and intellectuals. And with the new demands and the tremendous repression that came down on the party, there were many instances of people quitting the party, people not being able to stand up to the sharp repression. But what was even more striking was that once the armed struggle was initiated, that many, many new people stepped forward. One comrade I traveled with told me that he was in the city as a student studying all day when the People's War started. And he said that at night he would toss and turn, thinking about his village in the countryside and about the people waging the armed struggle in the countryside. He said he would finally fall asleep and dream that he was in the People's Army, but then he would wake up and still be in that small room in the city surrounded by his books. He said for 6 months he was in turmoil, deciding what he should do. And finally he decided to leave school and went back to his village. He told his family that he wanted to join the People's War, and his mother and father and his wife were really against it, he said. Not because they were against the People's War, but they were afraid for his life. And they struggled with him. They wanted him just to be a sympathizer. But he told me that he had to go up against all the people in his family. And he left the village and joined the People's Army and had been a full-timer ever since. This slide here is a picture, actually, of the moment that we entered Ropa, the Ropa district in the West. And Ropa is kind of the district in the West that's the heart of the revolution. It's the place where, from the very beginning of the armed struggle, has been where the People's Army has been the strongest, where there's been the most support. And so it was really kind of exciting after reading months of stories about the People's War being centered into Ropa to actually cross into the border into Ropa. The war, the initiation of armed struggle mobilized thousands of poor peasants in a way that had just simply not been possible before the initiation. In other words, the party had been doing for many years before the initiation a lot of political work and organizing in the countryside. But once the war actually started, it became possible and necessary to mobilize the peasants in a whole new way and on a whole different level. The poor peasants, including youth and women, now became the main forces. and it was the poor villagers all along the way as we traveled into these guerrilla zones who provided shelter and food and information about the police as we traveled through deep into Ropa and Rukum. Many times we'd be traveling for hours and hours, and we would come into a small cluster of houses, and people would come out and greet us heartily, give us food, give us water, a place to maybe rest for a few hours. And I could really see the kind of support that the People's War had in the countryside. These photos here are all taken in villages that are in the guerrilla zones, places that were supportive of the People's War. In the beginning, the fighting capacity of the guerrillas was just very, very primitive. I mean, they had never done anything like this before. And so they had to really begin from the beginning. And at first they were organized in two categories, basic small fighting squads and defense squads. And they were very inexperienced, and even more than that, they hardly had any arms at all. And in a lot of these pictures you'll see that the guerrillas have muskets. They're basically the kind of rifles that were used in the Civil War in the United States to fight. And here you see one of the guerrillas, he's got a musket in his right hand, and in his left hand is a homemade hand grenade. And so for a lot of these fighting squads, you know, their basic weapons were these old, outdated rifles, homemade hand grenades, and then also the traditional Kukri knife that the farmers use to chop wood and to cut grass for the animals. In the beginning, there were people's militias that were organized in local areas, and these were considered the basic forces to provide security on the village level. Then there were guerrilla squads of about 9 members that were considered the secondary forces. And the main force were the platoons of 27 guerrillas. And at the time I was there, they were just beginning to develop to the next higher stage of military unit, which is a companies, which is made up of about 3 platoons, so about 50 or more guerrillas. And since I've been there, the People's Army has just tremendously developed since then. And now the People's Liberation Army is waging battles involving thousands of soldiers and militia members in single battles. And this is only, in the space of about 3.5-4 years. And these pictures here are taken from a camp that I stayed in of the special, what was called at that time, the Special Task Force. And again, this was I was in Ropa and Rukum during the time of the elections. And so there was very much intensified fighting that was going on between the guerrillas and the government forces. And the government, in fact, had flooded those two districts with thousands and thousands of police to try to ensure that the elections would take place. And in response, the guerrillas had began, this was the first time that they began forming the company size, at that time called Special Task Force, to wage military operations to enforce a boycott of the election. In the beginning, most of the guerrillas and the commanders had no military experience whatsoever. As one party leader told me, he said, "We have learned that no one is born brave, but people can become brave in practice. When we practice warfare, we learn more lessons about war, and it makes us mentally prepared to go into battle. Now mentally we are prepared to fight, and ideologically and politically we are clear. But we have a crisis of arms. We are advancing our skills for warfare, but don't have the necessary weapons. So now we are concentrating on getting and capturing more sophisticated weapons." And this here, this was a young commander of a platoon that I met in Rukum. This is a district also in the west that's kind of in the heart of the revolution. And he was very young. He's about, I don't know, like 23, 24, commanding one of the platoons. As I traveled through the countryside, interviewing and talking with peasants and military commanders and party leaders, I really began to get a sense of and feel the excitement and vision that the masses and the party had of this revolution, how people were being mobilized to fight to liberate their country and to get rid of the corrupt and repressive government. I could see how there was a real pull and push dialectic going on. On the one hand, the extremely impoverished conditions and the village-level corruption and repression that the peasants felt was pushing them to look for a way to fight, to look for a way to get rid of the kind of caste oppression, the women's oppression, the impoverished condition. And at the same time that this push was going on, there was also a pull, which was the organized forces of the party and the People's Liberation Army that was giving the people leadership and showing them a way and organizing them to find a way to fight against their oppressors. This was a common vision and dream that was guided by the party, the Communist Party of Nepal Maoists, which is also a participating member of the Revolutionary Internationalist Movement. They are guided by the Maoist vision of protracted people's war, in which agrarian revolution and land reform are key, in which the peasants are mobilized around their demand for land, and with the seizure of land, it is redistributed. The feudal rule is challenged, the feudal culture is challenged, and the revolution lays the basis for eventually moving to collective ownership and working of the land under socialism. In the areas where the Maoists were beginning to have control, they were instituting new people's power and developing a new taxation system. They would burn land ownership records. They would redistribute land and basically organize peasants to both work the land collectively and also develop support on the villages to actually support the revolution and to support the People's Liberation Army. The Maoists in Nepal are carrying out the vision of Mao, protracted people's war, the strategy that is based in the countryside, that is aimed at surrounding the cities, seizing power, developing base areas that have been liberated from the and wrenched out of from control of the government forces. This is the revolution that they are waging is protracted on the one hand because the revolutionary forces start out weak, but they see that they must eat away at the enemy bit by bit and actually stretch out the war, protract it, to avoid decisive battles, to avoid the kind of battles that would totally crush them, to carry out the war in a way that allows the revolutionary forces to grow and build strength and to develop base areas throughout the country, increasingly taking up more and more areas in the countryside in which they are able to mobilize the people to exercise real power. When I was there, the party was carrying out what was called the fourth strategic plan of moving toward establishing base areas. And in many of the areas that I went to, these villages were becoming base areas in which they were organizing people's power. And these were like three-in-one committees made up of representatives from the party, the army, and different mass organizations. And this people's power would, you know, develop different committees to do everything from developing new taxation system, from carrying out people's courts, from developing health care, building schools, settling disputes in the villages. And since that time, this has developed to a whole higher level of parallel government in the countryside, which I'll talk about later in my presentation on the current situation. On the village level, the militias were developed to provide security for the surrounding areas and for the villagers, because in a lot of these areas that I was in, they weren't quite base areas or liberated areas yet, and it was a very tenuous situation where many times the guerrillas would be able to come into these villages and stay there for a while, but then the police would come in and they would have to leave. And so it was a very contested areas, and even in Ropa and Rukum, where these were the strongholds of the revolutionaries. Since that time, from what I understand, these areas are very, very strong base areas now, and government forces are basically not able to penetrate into these areas at all. These are all photos from a very strong area in Ropa. This is actually a village in Rukum, in which when we were leaving, the local militia was escorting us out of the village, and all the villagers were coming out to kind of send us on our way. Another really inspiring part of my trip was meeting the relatives of the many, many martyrs in this revolution. And in all of the villages that I went to, families would travel sometimes for days to be interviewed, to get their story written down in my journals. And these were people that had had their children, their brothers, their mothers and fathers killed by the police. And they wanted to have their stories told. They wanted their stories to be told to the world. This here is a photograph of Mohan Lal BK and Pabita BK, who were the parents of a 23-year-old young gorilla named Obi Ram BK, who was killed in Rukum in 1998. These two women came to talk to me, who are the relatives of Kami Buddha, who was actually a member of the Communist Party, who was one of the very first martyrs in the revolutionary movement in Nepal. He was killed by the government in 1955. And the woman on the left is the daughter, Moti Kali Poon, who was only 3 years old when her father was killed. The woman on the right was a 70-year-old sister of this martyr. And they talked about how they were carrying on, you know, the goal of their relative, who had been one of the first martyrs in the revolution. This young woman, Himali, was the 20-year-old wife of a 27-year-old Krishna Gurung, who was a martyr in the People's Army. She told me how her husband had been working in India when he first encountered, met some Nepalese Maoists. After the People's War was started in Nepal, he left India and came back into the countryside, and he joined the People's Army. And Himali was also in the People's Army, and they met, fell in love, and got married. But shortly after this, he was killed by the police, only a few months before this picture was taken. And Himali was pregnant with their child. But she told me that she planned on, after her baby was born, she planned on returning to her squad and continuing to fight in the People's Army. And one of the things that I really like and is very interesting about this photo is that you can see that she's wearing very bright colors, and she's also holding her hands out so that you can see that she's wearing bracelets, and she's wearing the tikka, the red dot on her forehead, and earrings. And all these things are actually very, very much in defiance of traditional Nepali customs, which feudal customs, which say that when a woman is a widow, she should wear black for the rest of her life. She should mourn for the rest of her life. She's not allowed to get married. She's basically not able to have any real life of her own. And so this was, she wanted to have her photo taken to show, you know, this kind of defiance, and that not only was she going to continue with her life, but that she was going to continue to dedicate her life to in the struggle for liberation. I also interviewed many, many people who had witnessed the police coming into the villages, rounding people up, torturing people, carrying away people who then were disappeared. And this guy here it's kind of hard to see in the photo, but he's showing me the wounds on his arm and on his shoulder where he had been shot and almost killed. And he told me, he said, when the police came into their village, they started rounding up people. And he told me, the police told us to come out of the house and said if we didn't, they would burn the house down and kill everyone. First, we sent my mother out, and the police arrested her. Then my wife came out, and they arrested her also. Then my father came out, and they arrested him. Only two of us were left inside, and when we came out, we were arrested, and they tortured us, beating us with sticks and the butts of their rifles. They tried to get us to tell about the party and our activities, but we didn't say anything. So then the police called the district and asked what to do. The order was given to kill us, and they stopped asking us questions. The police took my fellow comrade away and tried to get information from him. When he tried to escape, they shot him 10 to 12 times and killed him. Then the police took my father away and killed him also. When I tried to run, the police grabbed me and tied my hands behind my back. Again, I tried to escape, but after running about 60 meters, I encountered more police who caught me and others fired at me from behind. I was shot in the back and fell to the ground. Then the police went away, thinking I was dead. The government thought that such acts of cruelty and such acts of brutality would quickly crush the revolution. But from what I could see and hear in the voices of these peasants and the families of these martyrs, this kind of brutality had only deepened the people's hatred for the government. And actually, everywhere I went, I could see how honoring the revolutionary martyrs had actually become a very important part of the revolution. And this here is what they call a martyr's gate that was built in the countryside, and with the names of different revolutionary martyrs. And actually, this martyr's gate was in the district of Sayan, which is right bordering Ropa, and it's an area that at that time was not, it was pretty strongly supportive of the People's War, but it was still an area that was very strongly contested, so the police would come in and out of this area. And you could see how the police, you know, couldn't even stand, you know, these martyrs' memorials, and they would come and deface them. So you can see that's what's happened here, is that the police have come and basically defaced and tried to scratch out all the names of the martyrs. This was a photo I took in the east as we were leaving one of the guerrilla zones, and I mean, one thing is you can see what the land looks like. This is the kind of terraced farmland that the peasants try to eke out a living on. But beneath the tree down there on the left-hand side, what's happening there is that a platoon of the People's Army is clearing the land to build a memorial to the martyrs in that area. Many hundreds and thousands of people have also been just disappeared or been jailed. And this was a cap, actually, that had been made by prisoners in Nepal, revolutionary prisoners. The other thing that I, you know, really learned a lot about when I was there was the role of revolutionary culture in the guerrilla zones and the developing base areas. And everywhere I went, there were cultural programs that were put on for gatherings of the peasants. And there were actually cultural squads of the People's Army. That first excerpt that I read from dispatches, that was the cultural squad of the People's Army. In other words, these squads are actually units of the People's Army, and they're trained and armed to be able to fight. But their main task is to actually develop culture and to travel into different areas of the countryside and villages to carry out cultural programs. And these cultural groups are an important part of actually even preparing for the initiation before the war started. And because in a country, especially where there's a high illiteracy rate, I mean, basically most of the people don't read or write, that the role of culture becomes a very important vehicle for spreading even news about the People's War, about the different battles that are going on, and more importantly, spreading the and explaining the goals and aims of the revolution, and winning people to support the party and the People's Liberation Army. A lot of times these cultural programs, because of the security situation, the villagers would only be able to leave their villages after the sun went down in the dark, and they would travel in the dark without flashlights, which is basically the way we had to travel the whole time we were there. And so a lot of times these cultural programs wouldn't start till like maybe 11 o'clock at night, and they would go till maybe 3 in the morning, and then the villagers would have to leave to get back to their villages before the sun came up. but there would be literally, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people that would gather for these programs. A lot of these cultural groups would incorporate a lot of the traditional songs and dance in the Pali culture and then develop them with revolutionary content. And they would also do, you know, both singing and dancing. And in this case, they were doing a what they call kind of a revolutionary opera, in which they would, they both kind of acted out and sang the story of a particular battle that had gone on in which somebody had been martyred. And this was a scene from that encounter. They also, at the time, were doing skits to make fun of kind of the whole, you know, fraud of the election process going on at that time, because they were, you know, because there was a boycott going on. And so this was a little skit that they were doing. The guy on the right, with the white glasses on and the flag, is supposed to be like a corrupt politician from the one of the revisionist parties, the United Marxist, the Communist Party in Nepal, UML, which is actually a, they call themselves communists, but they are, you know, basically pro, you know, the working within the parliamentary system, and actually even had control at one point in the parliament. And so they were kind of making fun of, like, these politicians and how they try to trick the people into voting and promising them all kinds of things, but then once they get voted voted in, they don't do anything, which is kind of a universal message, I guess. It's kind of interesting because some of the people that I interview, one of the ways that they actually begin even getting involved in the People's War was through these cultural groups, that they were, you know, singers or dancers. And they, you know, when the cultural groups would come through, they would, you know, they really liked being part of these cultural groups. And then as they began working with the cultural groups, they began to learn more and more about the revolution and its goals and aims. And this was the way that a number of the young people in the villages actually, you know, became fighters and supporters of the revolution. Also, this photo was taken of a cultural program in Rukum, and you can see that. In many of these pictures, actually, you can see that there's different oppressed national minorities, and that a lot of their culture that is generally suppressed and denied and censored by the you know, the traditional Nepalese society was allowed to flourish and develop in the development of the revolutionary culture in these base areas. The other thing that was just completely not so much surprising but striking, in terms of the character of this revolution, is the tremendous role that women play. And I kind of knew about this before I went to Nepal, but once I got there, it was more than I could even imagine, in two ways. One, in terms of the deep, deep kind of oppression that these women face, the kind of feudal traditions that oppress women in many different ways. This is something that's, like, pretty universal in many, many third world countries, the kind of the ways that basic feudal tradition and religious tradition keep women basically nothing more than slaves of the household. And a lot of women that I interviewed, even some of these, many of these young women in the People's Liberation Army, talked about you know, how these traditions of arranged marriages, how they were denied education. 80% of the women are illiterate in Nepal. And also some people, you know, a lot of people, actually there's been exposure about, there's this whole sexual trade, the sex trade that goes from Nepal to India, in which many young women are literally kidnapped and sent to brothels in India. It's estimated that every year 10,000 young girls, some of them as young as 9 years old, are sold to brothels in India, and as many as 200,000 Nepalese women at any given time are working in India as prostitutes. And actually, I was just talking to someone the other day here in New York who had just recently been in Calcutta, and they were telling me that there is a whole red light district of an area in which there's literally 6,000 to 7,000 women working as prostitutes, and a huge portion of them are Nepalese women. And, you know, most of these young women die before their 30th birthday. And even if they are able to return to Nepal and to their village, they're totally ostracized and shunned because of, and shamed because of what they, you know, had done or been forced to do. In 1996, there was a raid on a brothel in India in which 218 Nepalese girls were found, and 70% of them were HIV positive. Given this kind of deep, intense oppression of half of the population in Nepal, that the women were some of the first and the most brave fighters to step forward and join the people's war. And this has been a very striking and major feature of this people's war, the participation of women. And the question of women's liberation has been an integral part of this revolution from the very beginning. Many of these women had to go up against all these traditions to join the people's army. And almost every woman that I talked to, in one way or another, had to really rebel against either her family or her village or traditions to join the people's army and to join the struggle. This one woman told me, she said she was a member of a people's army platoon, and she said, "At first my uncle, who was the head of the household, wouldn't give me permission to join the women's organization." This is the Revolutionary Women's Organization in the village. She said, "So I rebelled against this, and for 6 months I lived somewhere else. When I went back home, the family members would not accept me because of what I was doing. I went with the women's organization to my uncle and tried to convince him, talking about women's rights, and we did this many, many times. He did not speak against the women's organization, but still, he didn't want me to participate. He wanted me to stay home and do all the work in the house. But in spite of this and up against this, this young woman finally left the village and joined the people's army. When I was there, the party there told me that they had a goal of establishing at least 30% of the squads being made up of women, as well as 30% of the political leadership. And that also, that a lot of the barriers to this happening, in other words, it's one thing to have that goal, it's another thing to actually dig out against all the kind of traditions and barriers that prevent women from doing that. For instance, there's a question of collective childcare. A lot of the young women would sometimes even join the People's Army and then get married and get pregnant and have children, and then there's a question of how would they continue to participate in the revolution when they had children. And so the question of collective childcare was a huge question. Most of the women at that time that I met who got pregnant and had children would leave their children with their families, and their families would take care of them. It was one way that they could help support the people's war. But now I think that they have, you know, stronger and more stable, relatively stable base areas. There is the ability for the places where they have people's power to begin establishing much more collective forms of childcare. It's also a question of struggling against all the kinds of different traditions and ideology and political views that people have consider women as inferior to men. And one of the things that was really quite, you know, striking to me was the way that the People's Army itself set kind of a standard on the question of women's liberation. For instance, in a country like Nepal, it's just totally unheard of for the men to do a lot of different tasks, including like cooking and cleaning. And but everywhere that we went in traveling with the People's Army, that it was just basically every day. That a lot of times we'd be traveling, we would get to a village, we would stop late at night, and the men would immediately go about collecting and gathering the firewood and slaughtering a chicken if there was going to be chicken, or just cooking the lentils and rice and serving the meal. And, you know, this may not sound like a big deal, although I guess even in some households here it's a big deal, but in Nepal it's like really totally radical, you know, because, and I could see this in contrast to some of the villages that I went to that were less developed politically, in which we would go there and it would be the very traditional way of eating, in which the mother of the household would basically cook the meal, and then first all the men would come and eat, and she would sit there and serve all the men. And then only after all the men ate, then the other women and children would come and eat. And then after all they had eaten, then finally the mother would eat by herself. And this was kind of a very traditional way. But in the stronger guerrilla areas and where there had been more political work done among the masses, this was, you know, not the case. And the People's Liberation Army members themselves were kind of setting the standard for changing these kinds of social relations. And then in areas where actually there were larger formations of military units, like, for instance, when we stayed in the camp with the Special Task Force, you had this kind of more, you know, mass collective cooking that went on for large groups of people. So, in other words, one of the things that the revolution is doing is actually changing the kind of oppressive division of labor that is traditional to both feudal and capitalist society. One woman told me, she said, "There have been many changes in people's thinking since the initiation. Fathers and brothers are now involved in things like cooking, getting water, washing dishes. There is also a change in the women's thinking. Before, women were not permitted to do things like make the roof of the house or plow the fields. But now, where the people's war is going on, it is easy for women to do this. Women used to think they weren't good enough to do this work, but when we dared to do it, we found out this work was easy." The other thing that was really striking about this revolution was the sense of international solidarity that the people there had. And in every village that we went to, people enthusiastically gathered to greet me and, you know, to express, you know, feelings of solidarity, including with the struggle for of the oppressed people in the United States. And in every village that I went to, people would gather and ask a lot of questions about, you know, the situation of people in the United States. They wanted to know, you know, I mean, some of them even, because of the role of the party there, knew about and asked about other revolutionary struggles around the world. They wanted to know about the Philippines. They wanted to know about the people's war in Peru. I met people who had actually taken articles from the Revolutionary Worker newspaper about Mumia and translated them into Nepali and distributed them in Nepal. And people always made a point when I talked to them, and this was not just people in the party and in the army, the People's Liberation Army, but even just common peasants that I talked to, they always made a point of telling me that they saw their revolution as part of the worldwide struggle against imperialism and for liberation. One party leader told me, he said, "Our party, our leaders, are successfully leading the people's war in Nepal, and we're also proud that the Revolutionary Internationalist Movement is supporting our people's war. And so after you come here to talk face-to-face with us and learn about our people's war, we hope you will spread it all over the world." As part of the Revolutionary Internationalist Movement, the Communist Party of Nepal Maoists has emphasized that the collective knowledge and strength of the whole Revolutionary Internationalist Movement has played a role in the development of their people's war. This is from the time even before the initiation, with the start of the armed struggle, and in an ongoing way up to the present time. The Communist Party of Nepal Maoists sees that its theory and practice of carrying out the people's war in Nepal is a synthesis of the experience of the proletariat throughout the world, its successes as well as its failures. And they emphasize that this lends their revolution actually great strength and enhances its chances of success. Since I left Nepal, the military conflict in that country between the guerrillas and the police, and now with the Royal Nepalese Army, have increased by leaps and bounds and gotten more intense. The present government is completely unstable and fraught with continuous infighting over how to best deal and try to crush the people's war. This is a revolution that offers a ray of hope to oppressed people around the world. As Prachanda told me, Nepal is a small country. We are a small party, but we have a big perspective. Our people's war may be a spark for a prairie fire.